I've never looked at it.
The thing now we have two courses. One is recorded and posted to the blackboard so they can see. Even they can see the demonstration.
FBI's most wanted on most wanted list. By the way, Carsten Heger says hello to you guys.
Thank you. Thank you. Where did you see him?
I had an opportunity to travel with him and also he has that additional
Good afternoon, everybody. Please may I have your attention. I'd like to welcome everybody to today's colloquium. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce our own Chris Crawford as our today's speaker. Most of you, all of you from this department at least, know Chris very well. But I know there are a few out here in the audience who are not from our department, they're just visiting. So let me just give a very short academic overview of his background. Chris got his PhD from MIT in 2005. The focus of his PhD work was on measuring of nucleon electromagnetic form factors at low Q squared. And he also worked at the development of new techniques to polarize gas targets, hydrogen targets. Then in 2005, after he received his degree from MIT, he accepted a postdoc position at the University of Tennessee, and I forgive him for that, I must say. But anyway, at that time also, it seems like he developed a special interest in the study of precision measurement of fundamental symmetries in nature, such as parity and time reversal. So he started working on harmonic parity experiments and also searched for electric dipole moments of the neutron. And besides being a postdoc, he was also a visiting scientist at the Los Alamos National Laboratory during that time. In 2007, he joined our department and became a faculty member here. And since then, he has continued in his work of tests of fundamental symmetries. He's working on this. He's going to tell us about that today in his colloquium. But before I let him talk about it, I'd like to mention one thing. He actually won this year the early career award for young scientists from DOE, which is a very, very prestigious reward. And he got this, it's a 5-year reward, and he got this earlier this year. And so that's a very nice accomplishment. And without further ado, Chris.
Well, thank you. Ultimately,
I'll to admit, I'm a lot more nervous standing here in front of all of my friends. I'd much rather be around the world giving the same cloak pale. I don't want to compete with Mickey Mouse. And
you could be explained what was on that.
Yes, if we get there, and I hope I do. As a matter of fact, Joe's going to flag me down in 15 minutes and 30 minutes to make sure I do. So first of all, a question of what's missing in this picture? The EDM building, but that's beside the point. So I'm going to talk to you today about two different symmetries, fundamental nuclear symmetries and also electrodynamic symmetries. And I think both are equally interesting. I would say that's one of the main jobs of physicists is to look for symmetries, both as a real tool, like in particle symmetries, where you can actually discover new physics, but also just the idea of reducing ideas down to their, taking lots of different things and saying, oh, these are all the same, and reducing them down. And I think that's one of the most beautiful parts of physics, too. So today my talk is going to be quite scattered, and so this is probably the first two-dimensional outline you've ever seen. And let me explain. excuse me. Just this fall, my student Elise gave a talk on NPD gamma, and she did such an excellent job that it's a really tough act to follow. So what I'd like to do is kind of minimize that part of my talk and also talk about another an interest of mine, which is constructing magnets and some of the interesting results that have followed from that as well. So let me navigate you through here. So first of all, I'll talk a little bit about the properties of the neutron, including its structure and some of the interactions as seen by a low-energy neutron physicist. And then talk just a little bit about fundamental symmetries and really zone into the hadronic weak interaction. And just say some about the NPD gamma experiment, which I've been working on for the past 7 years now, and show some preliminary results. After that, I'd really like to zoom in on and talk about magnets. And so even though the talk's scattered, I'd say that there's a couple of kind of overarching themes. And one is the electromagnetism itself. And every time I tell someone about how I measure distances in the neutron that are so small that the neutron itself would have to do nuclear scattering experiments to resolve them, and they say, well, that's cool, but what are you going to make with it? And I have to say, well, smoke detectors and MRIs and PETs and before they say bombs. But at the end of the day, and maybe Joe's getting to me, but I start to really feel like I'm a nuclear physicist in an electromagnetic world. And so you can either fight them or join them. So I want to show some of the work I've been doing with that. Okay. And eventually I want to get to how to make these cool magnets with industrial robotic power. Okay, so first of all, I want to talk about the properties of this neutron. And so the main properties of the neutron, as far as I'm concerned, are, first of all, its only electromagnetic moment is a magnetic moment. And what that means is if you want to do neutron physics, you're going to have to build a magnet to work on it. Now, that's not quite true. The neutron also has mass, and it has a nuclear interaction. But with both of those, the best they can do is capture it or blow it up or something. But you can't really manipulate it like you can with an electromagnet. So again, that's an important point. Also, the neutron decays with its mass is very similar to the proton, so it decays with a very long lifetime. So going on to the structure, what does the neutron look like? Well, if you'd asked someone almost 50 years ago, for instance, at the Berkeley series of physics, you would have got plots that look like this. And this is the density of the neutron as a function of the radius. And it looks like it has kind of a hard core and then some sort of cloud charge outside of that, the proton versus the neutron. And in the last few years, we've refined that picture. And from electron scattering, we can probe the distribution of charge inside of the proton. And for the proton, we see that it doesn't have that peak, but it still does have that long tail, which is often called a planet cloud. And same for the neutron. They did get the right general shape, but you can see that it's quite far off. And as a matter of fact, This is actually blown to 5 times. So it's actually down at 0.1 here. So it's very much magnified. Now, I don't want to say which one is better, but I'll let you choose. But just note that mine has air bound. So where does this come from? It basically comes from elastic electron scattering. You have to take electrons at medium energy. Oh, the other thing I want you to notice is that down here, this data are attained by high energy electron scattering experiments. So we don't consider that so high anymore. Also, they hadn't figured out what the Fermi was yet, I'm assuming. But so if you measure the scattering cross section as a function of the energy of the photon, the virtual photon, and you plot that versus the energy of the photon, you get a curve that looks something like this for the neutron. And the low energy, the low momentum transfer data is what actually accounts for the cloud or the large tail. And in addition, the slope of course gives you the radius of the charge radius. So this data here was data that was obtained at BLAST. And it's interesting to this general shape here, a long time ago was parameterized by what's called the Gausdorff bit. And with no apparent reasoning for why they chose that parameterization. But what we notice is that if you do a parameterization like the same fit we do for the proton, it's a dipole, and it's basically 1 over tau squared. And you can think of that as this virtual photon coupling to mesons. And if you have two of those mesons that are close together in Q squared, or in mass, but in opposite charge, that would give you a dipole. And what's interesting is if you take that charge distribution of the neutron that we saw, you can think of that as two dipoles, one for the positive charge and one for the negative charge. And the other thing that I think is interesting is the reason that both of these work fairly well is because if you expand either of these in this dipole term, you end up with the same thing. The advantage of this one is that in the Gausdorff, if you try to do 3-parameter fit, which you can do if you include the radius from other experiments, it turns out the third parameter is actually is degenerate. So in this case, a fit like this would work better. Big Anand pointed out that 25 years ago, he had already come up with a real physical model that did have exactly this parameterization. So I just showed that there. Okay, so next for neutron interactions. So the first interaction is the nuclear interaction, and you can characterize the neutron proton potential basically by 3 parts. It has a repulsive core, which is like a contact potential, and then an intermediate region, which you can think of as heavy meson exchanges, and then the long range part, which can be the pion exchange or the Yukawa force. And if we just zoom in for very slow neutrons, all the neutron would see is just this very strong repulsive core. And so if we approximate that with a delta function, that would be the Fermi potential. And for cold neutrons, their wavelength would be such that instead of seeing a bunch of poles, it would, or a forest of poles, instead of seeing trees in the forest, it's the whole forest itself. And therefore, if we were to average, smooth out that potential, we'd end up with an optical potential or a step function. And so basically the neutron, if it does not enough energy, it would bounce off that potential. So neutrons traveling into a nuclear matter at more than 8 meters per second will reflect off of it. If you think about it, the neutron when it comes in, actually, it slows down in the transverse direction, and so it's actually a negative index of refraction. So that's how you can guide neutrons is with nuclear potential. The other thing one might want to do is to control the spin of the neutrons, polarize them or manipulate the spin. And there's 3 ways to polarize or analyze the spin of a neutron. The first way is with a highly spin-dependent interaction, N plus helium 3, goes to a proton and triton. I can make a hand-waving argument that's not quite true, but you can see this as spin-dependent, or plausibly, because these two neutrons, the spin of the helium is carried by the neutron, and so for this helium to enter the ground state and spin, it would have to have the opposite spin of the neutron already here. So if the spins are opposite, the cross section is huge, and if they're aligned, it's zero as far as anyone can measure. And so one can optically polarize helium-3 and pass neutrons through, and this will act as a spin filter and only pass one spin state. Secondly, you can use magnetic interactions themselves to polarize. So if we take that same nuclear optical potential and add in a magnetic interaction, depending on the spin, that will either be a positive energy, a repulsive or attractive force. And you can tune the two together such that one spin state feels no potential at all, where the other state feels quite a large potential. And so on this plot here, we're seeing basically the reflectivity, the percent reflected, as a function of its transverse velocity. And for one spin state, it's not reflective at all, except for a very, very small, there's a small bump there, very, very low velocities. Whereas the other one has it's reflective up to a very, very high velocity. In this case, almost 24 meters per second. And so basically the difference in area between here will give you the polarization that you can achieve. And so for this is a supermirror polarizer, and the polarization as a function of that transverse velocity is shown in blue here. And so you can get very, very high polarizations over a large kinetic range. And the third way is just to squeeze them up with a magnetic field. If the B field increases such that the magnetic potential is greater than its kinetic energy, it will again be reflected. And that's the type of gravity is in UCLA, for instance. So the last thing, once we polarize them, we have to transport that spin and maintain it and manipulate it. And so there again, we're going to basically use the main interaction is mu dot B, or if you have an electric dipole, D dot E. And because mu is also proportional to the spin, this acts like a gyroscope or a top. And the spin will process around the holding field at the Larmor frequency. And this you can do, there's many variations of how you can use this. For instance, we can do 50 minutes. We can do resonance spin flips, or we can do where basically we create an oscillating field that processes around the holding, or oscillates around the holding field the same speed as the spin is processing. And so because of that, the spin vector will actually see an opposite, will see an additional B field vector, and will tip up and down across that. And that's a Rabi transition. There's other things. You can modify the effective magnetic moment of the neutron. And the other one that I want to talk just a little bit about, because I'll be using it later, is if you want to preserve the spin of the neutron, if you want to slowly change the spin of the neutron, you have two choices. One is you can change your B field slow enough that it's an adiabatic transition, the spin actually follows the B field. The other is that you can make the B field change so sudden that the neutron's like a freight train, it just keeps on going the way it is until it has a new life, as a, for instance. If the B field switched, it would now be a spin down neutron. Okay, so now to the next part of the talk. I want to talk about fundamental symmetries and interaction. And 5 years ago, or six, I presented Spencer and Madison as my symmetry twins. And unfortunately, that's no longer, it's technically not possible anymore. And here's why. They're now my parity violation twins. But they're just as cute. So. So I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about fundamental symmetries. And there's a lot on this slide, but I'm not going to mention everything. But we all know that Noether's theorem connects continuous symmetries with conserved quantities. And this is the basis behind the field theories. But also, I think just as interesting are discrete symmetries, like parity, changing position, changing time, changing charge, or even exchanging particles. And there's a whole new, a different set of theorems. Noether's theorem doesn't apply because it only applies to continuous symmetries. But there's theorems that relate CPT and also spin to statistics. And what's also interesting is that the fundamental interactions, out of all the interactions, the only ones of them that violate these symmetries and for no reason we really understand, is the weak force. Now, that's not quite, that might not quite be true. There is a possibility in the strong force, theta GCD term, which has the capability, but as far as we know it, it's that term is zero. So we never observe parity violation in anything but the weak force. And therefore, we can use these facts to actually do searches for physics, new physics, or precision physics, by basically looking for observables that violate these, and that will be a clear signature of the physics that we're looking for. And some examples are the neutron electric dipole moment, which violates all parity CP and T, the neutron decay, which is parity violating, at least the spin correlations of decay products of the neutron. I'm going to talk about the hadronic weak interaction today, which violates parity. And finally, neutron oscillations, which violates baryon number. So going on to the hadronic interaction, this is, out of the weak interactions, this is probably the least understood. And the reason is because there's so much junk in there. It's Rene showed us last time that there's basically, it's all structure. And so, whereas if two quarks interact, that's just a plain finite diagram. For quarks, for two nucleons interacting, we have to look at the structure, quark, not just the fundamental interactions, but the structure as it relates. And the hadronic weak interaction is kind of in between the structure of nucleons and nuclear matter. So the other thing to note is that there's also, in addition to the weak interaction, there's a of the same nature, the strong interaction, which is 10 to the 7 times stronger. And so we really need the unique parity violation signature of this to take it up. And why do we want to study this? Well, just like Rene has said, showed us that gluons are an interesting that high energy proton collisions are a new probe of the structure of the proton. In a similar way, we could think of the hadronic weak interaction as one more microscope that we can use to look at the structure of the neutron. So we need a formalism to think about the hadronic weak interaction. And the one that was used for the longest time is based on the Meson exchange model. And the only difference is to take all of the different Meson exchange terms and the operators and replace them with parity violating, their parity violating counterparts. And if you look at all the different types of interactions you can have, you can parameterize them by isospin, the range, whether it's a pion or a contact potential, and also by angular momentum. And this is just listing out the different operators, isospin and spin operators, and momentum and space. And if you do that, you end up with six parameters, a long-range pion coupling constant, isospin 1, where that's the change in isospin compared to here, and then and then five contact potentials. And you can actually get the five contact potentials by doing a much simpler thing. Just think of a nucleon-nucleon elastic scattering as a black box, and look what goes in and what comes out. In this case, you have spin 1/2 plus 1/2 and isospin 1/2 plus 1/2. And so if you make your, it's a fermion, so if you make your total wave function anti-symmetric and you conserve total angular momentum, you end up with, and you look for S to P transitions because those will be parity violating. You end up with two S states and three P states. And out of those, there are five different couplings. Three here because of the isospin 1, so there's three isospin substates. And these map onto the 3-5 DDH parameters, and also similar parameters you can get from lower energy effective field theories. And so you've already seen existing data. I just wanted to point out that there's a new player in the field that's not experimental data, but it's almost experimental data because from QCD. And so now, in addition to our 18 fluorine measurement of the long-range coupling constant f pi, we now have a new, the very first lattice QCD calculation of f pi. So now, in addition to comparing with models, we can actually compare with something that derives straight from QCD. So as far as theory, so the question is, how do you extract these coupling coefficients? Well, if you want to extract six different numbers, you better make at least six different measurements. And so what this table shows here is some of the few-body experiments that one can do that feel this hadronic weak interaction. And each of them has a different sensitivity to each of the six different coefficients. And so, for instance, the experiment I'll talk about a little bit, NPD gamma, is almost exclusively sensitive to F pi, whereas a new experiment that wasn't on this chart the last time I showed you, and helium 3, you can see it also has very strong dependence on the isospin, the two isospin zero couplings. Okay, and so so our basic plan is to replace all of the nuclear measurements that have been made with few body measurements, because they don't depend on the nuclear structure, just the subnuclear structure. And by doing that, basically, here shows some numbers for how we can improve by measuring NPD gamma and then helium 3 observables. And basically, we can do better than before with only few body terms. And also, I'd like to point out that we now have few body calculation of the N helium 3 reaction. Okay, so the NPD gamma experiment, what are we doing? Okay, so so in this case, the NPD gamma experiment is where our goal is to measure the parity violation observable, the correlation between the spin of the neutron and the direction of a photon that's emitted as the neutron captures on a proton. And you can see in this picture that it violates parity, basically because spin is a pseudovector and momentum is a vector. And so I'd just like to acknowledge our collaboration. So the basic components of the experiment are that we need a polarized neutron that's spin polarized, we need a proton target, and then we need to detect the upcoming gamma. And so up to here is all of the spin polarization. The neutron, polarized neutron part of the experiment. We have a proton target, which is liquid hydrogen, and then detectors here. And so I'll talk just very briefly about each of these. So, and then this shows the experiment as a model as it appears at BSMS. We have a neutron beam coming in, a spin flipper, a polarizer, which is different from the one at Los Alamos, a hydrogen target that fits in between cesium iodide detectors around there, and then a beam stop. So the SNS, just for those of you who are unfamiliar with the SNS, it's a neutron, it's a $1.4 billion neutron machine. The way it works is it accelerates protons to about 1 GeV of energy. They're accumulated in a ring and impinge on a liquid mercury target, and that basically spalls or frees up free neutrons, about 30 per proton, that then can be moderated in liquid hydrogen moderators and guided towards different experimental halls using neutron supermirrors. The nice thing about this technique is that you get, you can, since all of the neutrons start at the same time, we can measure their energy from time of flight. And if you do that, you get a time of flight structure that looks like this. It's basically a Maxwellian distribution. About the temperature, a little bit above the temperature of the liquid hydrogen moderator, because you don't want to completely moderate, or your chances are you're going to kill your neutrons. They're going to capture before they can escape. Out of this, a pulse happens every 16 milliseconds, so we don't have time to take all of these neutrons. We, at this point, we're going to have another spectrum which follows right from behind. And so you can, I think Elise already showed this, didn't you? If you don't remember, let me just summarize really quickly. So if you take that neutron energy spectrum in time, basically you can think of at the detector here, you're measuring neutrons that at the initial pulse here were traveling at this velocity and took this amount of time to reach the detector. So the fast neutrons will be detected immediately, and the slow ones will be detected out on the tail. And if we want to just for instance, if we want to know exactly the speed of the neutron so that we can flip its spin and not other and have preserved high polarization, we want to cut out these. And the way to do that is to stick in a chopper. And sticking a chopper at a certain distance before we get to our real target. And if we turn off the neutrons, or if we block any neutrons that are faster than this, and take and then block them any that are slower than that, we can actually select one particular window. And by doing that, so the idea is that we have only one velocity range of neutrons hitting our detector at any point in time. And what you see here is a cheating neutron that actually was so slow that it got lapped and ended up contaminating our spectrum way out there. And so the thing to do, thank you, is to add another chopper, and then you can come up with a clean spectrum. And so here's a plot of our chopped neutron spectrum. There are a few wraparound neutrons, we call them, but they're very small, that they don't contaminate our spectrum substantially. And this is the final spectrum that we actually record in our detectors. You can see both time of flight in milliseconds and its energy, or its wavelength in angstroms. And you can also see drag peaks here, where the neutrons are scattered from the aluminum windows. So my student, Elisa, actually measured the flux from the neutron beamline as it came out from the polarizer. And she used this apparatus here, which has a boron target and a cesium-iodide detector and a shutter to cancel out backgrounds. And these are the red are the pair measured distributions in both the vertical and horizontal positions versus simulations of the neutron polarizer from Monte Carlo. And you can see it; they agree very well. One of UK's jobs was to design the Supermir polarizer for the FNPV. And the way that polarizer works is it has a bunch of these magnetic supermirrors that only reflect one spin state. The other one is absorbed inside boron in the class. And so we were able to design a neutron polarizer that had 30% transmission out of a 50% max, right? Because you have to get rid of 50% anyways. And almost like 95% polarization. And that was also measured using a helium-3 spin filter. This is a picture of the polarizer. And you can see that the measured polarization was within 1% of our design parameters. And this is Elise and Matt looking very perplexed at their helium analyzer. So the next is, after we have polarized neutrons, we actually want to flip them back and forth very quickly so that every other pulse has the opposite spin. And thus, if anything changes in our experiment on a very slow time scale, we'll measure both rates so that we can cancel out any systematics. So fast spin flipping is one of our biggest handles on systematics. And the way we do that is I described earlier with this resonant spin flipper. Note that different times, different speeds of neutrons are coming through. So we actually have to ramp down the magnetic field or the RF field inside of the spin flipper to allow for a complete rotation of the spins of every single velocity. And so this is the longitudinal solenoid that creates a longitudinal field to rotate the transversely polarized neutrons sideways down, and that's called a spin flip. Okay, what I want to show you is a new design that we came up for the N-helium-3 experiment. The problem with N-helium-3 experiment is that it's very sensitive. There's many systematic errors that can come in if you have transversely polarized neutrons. So what we had to use in that experiment were neutrons that are polarized longitudinally in the direction of their travel. And now, if you have a longitudinal holding spin flipping field, it's not going to do anything. So we had to come up with a transverse RF field to basically tumble the neutrons forward. And we come up with a winding pattern to wind one of those in such a way that had a small form factor. And the additional nice effect is that whereas a solenoid has fringes in the front and back, since for a winding pattern like this, where the field would be transverse, the fringes are all outside the path of the neutron. So it has the possibility for even higher spin flip efficiency than one that's the other way. And this here is actually a prototype of what that would look like. And we'll get back to that a little bit later. Okay, and then beam monitors, which I'm going to rush over a few slides here so we can get some fun stuff. So the second part we need is the proton target. This is the backside of the hydrogen, liquid hydrogen targets, the cryogenic target, and we'll see why in a second. here's the cryovessel that contains 16 liters of liquid hydrogen. And if you've ever tried to tell a lab director that you want to put 16 liters of hydrogen that close to his nuclear solution source, it's a very challenging project. And it took us many years to get this approved at the SNS. The reason it has to be cryogenic is because there's two states of hydrogen, ortho and para. And one of them will actually depolarize neutrons. And so we have to make sure we're in the lower energy state. And one way to do that is just to rely on Boltzmann statistics and get the target really cold and do that. And just to illustrate the point, you can see this is a MCMP simulation of our target. Neutrons are coming in from the left. And with normal hydrogen, they're almost instantly scattered out of the beam and depolarized, of course. But a para-hydrogen target you get almost 100%. Well, you still have scattering, but it's the majority of the neutrons are actually captured in the target. So this was a fractious day, the day that our target actually got installed into the beam and passed the SNS reviews. You can see a real picture of the target here. Here's where the actual hydrogen resides. This is the detector, the cesium-iodide detector, and the polarizer and monitors are upstream here. The neutrons are coming in from behind this biological shield. So finally, the one thing that hasn't changed in the experiment is our detectors. It's still a current mode, and we just sit there and count not individual gammas from neutrons, but just current. So last time I showed you data from LANTS, we were able to measure the symmetry to a precision of, or to uncertainty of 2 times 10 to the minus 7. That's not good enough. We expect the value to be around 5 times 10 to the minus 8. Just as a status report, we're currently taking we took some preliminary data this spring. And now for the next year, we'll be taking our real physics data, and hopefully by next spring, we should have a final result for infinity gamma asymmetry and for the coupling constant f pi. But what I can show you are a very large asymmetry from chlorine, and what I've shown here is the asymmetry in each detector in our array, and over it's superimposed on that is just a factor that accounts for the angle that we'd expect. So, for instance, a detector on the top, we expect a positive symmetry. Detector on the bottom, we expect a negative. And you can see that there's very good, our data matches very, very well with the actual detector position. Also, we need to measure aluminum symmetries since there's a lot of, the target itself has aluminum backgrounds. We need to subtract out any parity violating symmetries from the aluminum, from capturing the aluminum itself. And so we've taken some preliminary measurements with the aluminum. The target was constructed at UK. And again, we have preliminary data, which we hope to publish pretty soon.
Sorry, Chris, what is the difference between the green and the blue there?
Oh, I kind of glossed over that, sorry. This curve here really follows a cosine theta, right? Because we expect up and down. So that, because that's along the direction of the neutron spin, that would be a parity violating observable. There's also a parity parity conserving observable, which is the velocity of the neutron, its spin, and the direction that it recoils. And that's a k cross signal. So that's parity conserving, and that would manifest as a left right symmetry. You have more balance to the left and to the right, and so that would be like a sine theta. And so in this plot here, we can see are the parity conserving asymmetry from aluminum, which is there. That's a strong nuclear process, and then the parity conserving part. And both of them are backgrounds that we have to account for. And finally, I can just show you a status report of update from our hydrogen data. This is data taken in 8 days during the spring. It's shown by ring number. The statistics aren't big enough that you can see any real physics of symmetry. And also we haven't done background subtraction and other things. But basically, this this plot here is a confirmation that it'll take approximately 200 days of beam time to come up with our final result. Okay, so with that, I want to go on and talk about precision electromagnetic coils and symmetries. And I've got 20 minutes. Okay, here we go. So let me just set the stage by showing you some of the design or some of the problems that we had to solve. And these problems were actually for the neutron EDM experiment, but similar problems were posed in other experiments. For instance, how to make a transverse spin flipper for the implant three experiment. In this case, this is in the insides of the neutron EDM cryostat. The measurement cell is way back in here. What you see are a whole bunch of plumbing to introduce polarized helium 3 and our superfluid helium. We need a vent stack in case we have a catastrophe. But one of the things that we need to do is for the neutron EDM experiment, sorry, I don't have time to go over the physics, is we need to introduce polarized helium 3 into the measurement cell. And to do that, we need to have a constant guide field all the way through all this plumbing to guide the spin of this helium atom nucleus into the cell. Okay, and we tried to just using conventional coils to make this constant uniform holding field, and you can see all sorts of crashes. And this doesn't include field cancellation coils. If we were to use this, the stray fields from this would completely devastate the experiment. So in addition, we need another set of coils to cancel out any fields so we don't have any external fringes. Another problem we had was guiding the polarized neutrons into the cryostat, into the measurement cell. Here are the two measurement cells of the EDM experiment. All this is the cryostat. The main holding field is right here, so if we can get neutrons to this point, we're fine. But we have to somehow guide them through that region, in a region where we can't have any metal because the fringes, or just the magnetic material would capture the Earth's flux and modify it. That would be worse than actually shielding our own fields, okay, so it would be worse than our own fringes. So we need a region here to produce a coil that guides the flux, guides the polar spin of the neutron from a high field down into a very low field, a 40 milligauss region. So we have to taper down the magnetic field in such a way that we preserve this adiabaticity condition. In addition, we have to completely eliminate any fringe fields, but our hands are tied because we can't put any magnetic shielding around it to do so. And so so those are the types of questions that we wanted to answer. And in coming up with in trying to solve these, we came up with a very interesting new interpretation of the magnetic scalar potential. And just before I mention it, if you look in Jackson or any respectable book, what they'll tell you is that the scalar potential is useful at times, but it really has no theoretical significance, and it's just kind of a bystanding. Well, you could think of it as similar to the electric potential if you had north and south poles, so magnetic charge. But I mean, so it is, people do use it for that, but it really had no physical interpretation. It was just kind of a ploy to get what you wanted done. Okay, so in order to come up with this physical interpretation, what I want to do is consider the boundary conditions where the magnetic field would change. And in this case, if we had the current sheet, which is pointed into the board here, we know that just from physics 232 that those currents are going to kink our gear field lines, right? So the magnetic flux is going to be conserved because of because del dot B equals zero. So we're going to have the same number of field lines. They're just going to have a kink there. Okay, so let's go back and analyze that kink. For, of course, we get that from del cross Ampere's law. And the corresponding boundary condition says that my normal, which will be pointing to the right, crossed with the change in the tangential component of my H field. So in other words, that's my boost that H kinks downwards. So N cross H equals my surface current, which actually should be into the board, shouldn't it? It should be into the board, sorry. So if you interpret this now in terms of not the fields, but the scalar potential, where the remember that the B field is the gradient of U, the magnetic scalar of potential. And so what I've shown here are equipotential surfaces. If you actually write that same boundary condition in terms of our potentials, let's actually do it. So first of all, what I want to show is there's a relation between the equipotentials here along the surface and my surface currents. So first of all, we know that that the equipotentials are perpendicular to my H transverse, right? Since the field H field is the gradient of U, it's going to be the equipotentials are going to be perpendicular to the H vector. But also from this equation, my surface currents are perpendicular to my H vector. Yes, Bian.
Do you see something more about the magnetic scalar potential? What is magnetic scalar?
Oh, yeah. What's the magnetic scalar potential?
Magnetic field doesn't point no source. Why there's a magnetic scalar?
Yes. Let me do that in the next slide. I'm trying to confuse you here so I can clear it up in the next slide and myself. Okay. Is that fine? So. Anyways, because both the equipotentials and K are perpendicular to H, we can say that the equipotentials are actually flow along our K. So our surface current flows along our equipotentials. The other thing we can do is we can integrate K, our surface current, from this point to this point, or this point to this point. And what we'll find is we're just integrating across the gradient, and that is just the change in our potential. So it turns out that the difference between two equipotentials on the boundary condition is actually the change in current. It's the amount of current that flows between those two equipotentials. Now that may seem, I think it's amazing. My first time we realized that it was just wow. But actually it's not, because if you just do a simple Ampere's law around here, it's obvious, right? Because Ampere's law just says the change in potential. And because it's a non-conservative field, there is a change in potential going around the loop. That change in potential is delta U, or the total current in between those two points on the loop. But what I want to do now is jump into the symmetries part and show you some pictures that kind of illustrate this and hopefully make it just a little bit more intuitive. And what I want to build on is the intuitiveness of our standard picture of the divergence. And what is that picture? Well, the picture is that charge emanates, so field lines or flux tubes, electric flux, emanates from point charges, or from charge, right? And so that's just a statement of the divergence theorem if we interpret the divergence to be the boundaries of our flux line. So in other words, at the end of every flux line, we call that our divergence, and we just put a point charge there. And so to take the divergence of a field which is represented with flux lines, you just put boxes of charge at the end. And of course, that's related to Gauss's law, because the dots at the boundary of a line are equal to the inside of a volume would be the number of lines across that volume. That's something we all know, right? But there's an equally interesting picture for the magnetic field, which is actually very symmetric to that. And now, instead of our sources being charges, our sources are going to be currents. And so how do we have flux emanating from current? You can't, because it's not a dot, right? So instead, we're going to have to come up with a new geometrical feature that emanates from this line here, or has a boundary being our currents. And so he would say the charge is the source of flux. Our current is going to be source of something else. I'm going to call that something else flow, where flux is a area integral of the field, E dot dA. Flow is just the potential. It's just the integral of E dot dl. Okay, I just want to give it, I want to make it on the same footing as flux, because it's an age of equality, right? So if we take the integral of E dot dl and we call that flow, the flow surfaces are the surfaces where there is no flow. Now this is almost but not quite equipotential surfaces. It's not equipotential surfaces because there's no potential. It's not a conservative field. And for instance, in this case, we can go around. We can count the flow by just counting the number of surfaces that our path passes through. But we don't get zero if we do a closed loop in all cases. As a matter of fact, that's an illustration of Stokes' theorem. So for the electric, those flow surfaces do connect into nice smooth, or I should say nice closed surfaces, and that's just a statement of the conservative field at its equipotential. On this side, it doesn't, but we can still call these flow surfaces, we just can't call it equipotential, unless we consider a region where there's no charge, and then it is. So hang on, what is flow? What is the magnetic scalar potential? I'm not quite sure what you were asking, actually.
What is H? H is the magnetic
field? H is the magnetic field.
If H is the magnetic field, that means the divergence of the magnetic field is not zero.
So it's a potential, but it's not a potential energy. And that's going to be a crucial point in just a second. Okay, thanks. Okay, so it's a potential in the sense, well, it's not really a potential, right? It's just a, well, it's a potential in the fact that H is the gradient of U. Okay, but it's also, in cases where we don't go around a singularity, we can actually treat these flow sheets as equipotentials. Okay? It's just that we're going to have singularities from Ampere's law. But you see the same picture. We have our field is emanating from our sources, or we can say the source is at the boundary of the field, just the way as the source is the curl or the derivative of the field. And so on this side, you can see closed flow surfaces. So where here we have closed flow surfaces, here we don't. The analog on this side is the fact that we have closed flux lines. Okay. And so there's a complete backward symmetry here, which we already know from Maxwell's equations. But this is just a picture that shows that symmetry a little bit more explicit. And the other thing we find, which should not be surprising, is that these symmetries are basically just, they're just off by one dimension. E fields are flows, B fields are fluxes, where one's a one-dimensional, one's a two-dimensional angle. Okay? And so now, all my statement was before was that if you can solve if you can solve a problem with the magnetic scalar potential, what we know already then is that the boundary of that potential is going to have a wire or current flowing along it. And so that's probably an easy way to envision what I tried to fluff by you in the slide previous. So let me give a couple of examples. I'm rapidly running out of time. But so the first example that we all know or are familiar with is a solenoid. In that case, the current flows around this way. And the equipotentials are just the disks in between the loop of current. And sure enough, they're perpendicular to the field lines. The second is one that we're very familiar with in the low-energy neutron business, is a cosine theta coil. If you want to make a transverse field, like for our spin flipper, basically, the current density, K, has to go as cosine theta, so that most of your current is on the top and coming back along the bottom. Well, in terms of potentials, that's a no-brainer because our field is constant, therefore our equipotentials are equally spaced. So we put a wire at the top of each surface here and a wire at the bottom of each surface. The wires wrap around according to the right-hand rule. X, which is the spacing between the wires, is just our cos theta. So there's our cosine theta. So I think what I'd like to do is just continue this this imagery and some points which I think are just kind of interesting between the symmetries. And then maybe I'll just flash an example of a coil that we built. Okay, so so we've already seen a separation of characteristics of the electric and magnetic fields into their flux and their flux tubes and their flow sheets, okay, which count either flux through a surface or flow or in E dot DL along into a path. And that's very similar to just a projection of a vector into its normal component and its transverse component, which we can write this way, maybe over here because you can't see it here. We can do the same thing with the Laplacian. We can take its longitudinal and transverse components. That's just a vector identity. But if you write that in terms of flow and flux, flow surfaces and flux sheets, we see that this really is a longitudinal projection in the sense that the change in the field is in the direction of the field here and is transverse to the direction of the field here. Or in this case, we have our flow surfaces are constant for a longitudinal, our flux is constant for transverse. Now, the interesting thing is if we take this inverse and or the Laplacian, we actually invert it, but we slide it past the first gradient into this position right here, and also into this position right here. What we end up with is the Helmholtz theorem, which says that a field can be written as a gradient and a curl, where the source is the divergence, and the potential is the inverse Laplacian of the source, of course, using Green's functions. And likewise, for the other term, your current is at the source of the field, and the field is the curl of the potential. And so from this, it's obvious that the relation between your source, your potentials, and your sources is just Poisson's equation, or the inverse of that. The last thing I want to do is that because of basically the derivative of one thing is the derivative of another, we can organize all of the quantities in the electromagnetics in terms of a derivative chain, where the derivative of, so that going to the right is taking a derivative, for instance, a divergence or a curl or something. And so basically, taking the derivative of our E and B field is, and the derivative of our D and H field give us Maxwell's equations. The thing I should also note is that taking any two derivatives, because the derivative I said before was like the boundary of a geometrical object, if you take another derivative, you're going to take the second boundary, and that will be zero. So any two derivatives are zero, and this therefore this turns into an exact sequence where this, the image of this is completely wipes out in the next time around. And so because of that, then we have our continuity equation here. And the converse of that is that because the derivatives of E are zero, the E's can be expressed as the derivative of something else, the potentials. And likewise, if the derivative of the potential is zero, then that derives from a gauge. And so all of the quantities in electromagnetics can be put along this derivative chain. And I think one thing that's interesting, that I have no idea what it means, probably nothing, is if you look at Noether's theorem, it's basically connecting the two laws that are at both ends of the derivative chain. It's kind of interesting. I have absolutely no idea. It probably doesn't mean anything, but it's still interesting. So what I'd like to do in the last few minutes is we've already talked about how to construct coils. You just use flux boundary conditions. You decide what flux you want to come in. For in this case, we want flux to continue from the inside of a perfectly straight one, go around the corner, and come back to this side. We don't want any flux to escape, so we impose a boundary value problem with zero flux on the outside, flux source here, flux drain here. We solve Laplace's equation on the inside. Once we have that Laplace's equation for our scalar potential, we automatically have our windings of the magnet that we use to create that field. In this case, our field lines go like this, so our fluxes, you can be able to see them, are these perpendicular lines to the equal potential sheets. And along the boundary of that region, we just wind those line, and that will give us a coil that will give us exactly that magnetic field. And that image there is actually explicitly, or I should say, hardware built right here. If you come up afterwards and look here, you can see the lines here cut where we basically etched a printed circuit board into traces so we could separate, put a different current along each path. And then my poor graduate student had to solder over 1,000 wires together to connect each of these faces into a coil wound in series. And so if you look at this coil, it basically has, it's a path that, is, you can think of it as a wire wound coil where the current comes from here down the back and then back inside the middle and just keeps on winding around like that forever until it gets down to the other side. Anywhere where we go from one coil over to the next, we have a little bit of current going down. We have to cancel it out with the return current coming back before we connect them up in the end. So everything has to be kind of hermetically sealed up like that. So here's the picture. And thanks to Brad for helping us map the field of this trial coil. One thing that I didn't mention is that you have to, this physical interpretation that magnetic scalar is a source potential. In other words, it describes where the sources are. The stipulation is that you have to do that same interpretation everywhere where there's magnetic fields. So in addition to winding a coil around the outside, we also have to wind a coil on the inside with those same, using that same technique. This time, since the field is constant, we'll just have a current sheet on the inside. For our investigations, we only made the outside flux return part of it. And by simulation, you can see if you add the inside coil here, which is kind of like a solid almost. This is what you see here is the B field, the horizontal, the transverse component of the field as you go along longitudinally through the center of this magnet. And this would be the field from the inside, this is the field from the outside coil. The inside coil has a couple of current sheets, so as you pass through that, you actually have a singularity. But if you add up the two fields from the two coils, you indeed do get a field that's zero outside with no fringes, and then a very uniform field on the inside. And so what we did was, with Brad's field mapping, we actually measured this component of the field and added this part later, just from calculation. And sure enough, as we do that, we got a very, very uniform field when we were all done. And so, I think I should really stop there. But what I was trying to convince you is that this actually becomes a very powerful technique for not just iteratively, trying to change things until you come up with a magnet that works, but actually calculating the windings of magnets for any particular problem that you want to solve. We hope this is a very general technique. The only one thing is that it's only for surface currents, since of course the magnetic scalar potential is only defined where there are, like Aeon says, where there are no currents. So all of the currents have to be in at the boundaries of your regions. And what I didn't get a time to show you was how we're actually going to save our graduate students from doing so much soldering and become more precise. And basically, the purpose of Sunflower downstairs is we're going to put a dentist drill in her arm, and she'll just go around and do the same thing. But instead of soldering traces together, we'll electroplate a form, maybe like this, with copper everywhere around it, and just cut the circuit right around, according to the exact calculations of some finite element analysis. Okay, I'd like to stop there, and thank you.
Chris, do you have any questions?
Yes. Well, so is this picture the theory, or is that the American measurement?
This is actually a physical coil. What you see here is it's a Biot-Savart-Lau simulation. We took actual real measurements, but just of what you see there, the outer coil. So in order to get something understandable, we have to add a simulated outer coil, this blue line. So we took measured data plus the blue data that we didn't have any device for. And when we added that, we got basically something that depends on our, it gives us a measure of the quality of at least the outside coil. I didn't get to show you, but you can actually combine the two coils into a single winding, in which case we won't have that difficulty anymore.
Do you have a comparison between theory and experiment?
Yeah. So it's at least along the center line, it was better than 1% match. And I judiciously made it small enough that you can't see the differences.
I wasn't going to see that.
Those differences we actually traced back to along this here. And you can see the solder actually loops out a little bit. And so if you take what the computer told us to do, and I always do what the computer tells me to, and, well, I don't know. So this is what we really did. So the imperfection, you could say, or the perturbation we did to our real solution was to do this and not that. And so we get a dipole. And so all those little dipoles added up to produce a non-negligible error at the precision that we need for EDM experiments.
Okay. Any more questions?
Yeah.
thinking, is it F pi is the gradient force of the asymmetry of that measurement?
Yes,
And you mentioned the lattice QCP calculations, is it F pi again?
Yeah, that's a happy coincidence. Actually, it's not a coincidence. So if we see here, this is NPD gamma, and its sensitivity to F pi is, so in a symmetry of 5 times 10 to the minus 8 means an F pi of 5 times 10 to the minus 7. And here's this, on this graph, this is F pi in this direction. And here's the prediction, the best guess of DDH, the DDH paper. The current measurements indicate an F pi of 0, and the last QCD calculation is actually closer to experiment than this Mason exchange theory. But the question is, so we'd like to really verify that with few body observables.
So if this is do you really need the precision then to compare to the lattice calculation, or can you already make a statement with?
No, our precision is as wide as this plot right now. Well, not quite, but.
So we need it. Okay.
Yeah, we really need that extra. So our goal is to have the same precision as the Fourier 18 measurement, so that we can really compare head to head.
Any other questions?
I was just going to make a comment. The WASI calculations, just at best proof of principle, there are significant pieces that have been left out. And so I wouldn't necessarily regard that calculation by any means as being really good. I have a question maybe. In principle, we saw a seminar today where we were talking about how there are issues with correlations between the actual accelerator and its Celestine state. And so I just wonder, what kind of issue is that for NPD gamma, and how do you address it?
Well, it's a real issue. Now, it's very different regimes. They're talking about relativistic speeds. We're talking about,
So my simple question is, you imagine that you have a neutron polarized with or against the flow of the beam, and you just want to know whether the flux of the beam depends on the velocity of the neutron. And that's all I want to know.
Oh, yeah, so that's one thing we have to measure. So we actually, it's trivial for us to measure. They have all sorts of problems with, small movements of the beam with respect to helicity. Maybe it steers just a little bit. We don't have that because we don't have a beam. We have like a sewage pipe with neutrons. So we don't have to worry about those sorts of symptomatics like they did for the proton paradigm experiments. But we do have to worry about, so that would be a fault of symmetry. If there were more neutrons spin up than spin down, that's first order. That's not even a dilution, that's a fault of symmetry. So we actually measure it with the beam current monitors. And so we form just a beam of symmetry all on its own before we do a paradigm symmetry.
Isn't that
significant
super ratios per se?
Yes, so it does, you're right. Yeah, so there's actually two different asymmetries that both are deadly. One is beam fluctuations, the other are detector efficiencies. And so what we do is we vary both of them. So we have a plus and a minus detector, and we have a plus and minus spin filter. And so by doing comparing these two, with different spin states, we can figure out the detector efficiencies. Vice versa, by looking at by taking two detectors with the same spin state, we can also cancel out sensitivity to the neutron flux.
No questions?
Don't we get to
see the Mickey Mouse movie?
Oh, did you not see it first? It's not, it's just... it's not a... How do I turn it on?
Is
push the button?
Is it an AutoCAD of some sort? It's not a picture. Okay.
Is Mario here? Oh, I didn't quite finish. I'm sorry. I have to flash up one slide because I'd be negligent to take credit for all this. I just wanted to acknowledge the students who have worked with me on these projects. And in my own opinion, the quality of the department really is the department is good as its graduate and its undergraduate students. And I've been very blessed in our department. We've had some excellent students who I've had the privilege to work with. And I think that's good news for our department. So. And one of those students, Mario, is actually the one who is not here. He actually constructed that video, programmed the whole thing in MATLAB. That actually was not in my lap. I claim exhaustion.
He's still be here.
That was during his REU project at Washington. How does this turn on? Does someone know? Do you know how to? I'm sure it's simple. Oh, there we go. Thanks. Okay, so I should explain what this is. First of all, when we purchased the robot, I had no idea that it was actually going to be so difficult to actually go from having a robot planted in a basement to having coils. And there's a lot of problems. The first problem is that it's very precise. It'll do the same thing over and over every single time, but it's not very accurate. You have to pay a lot of extra money for that. And so what we've been spending the last year doing is with lasers, pointing lasers at things and measuring, trying to basically calibrate a matrix that goes from, basically calibrate 24 degrees of freedom, which are basically all of the different ways that a joint can be off. And if you look at this robot, it's a six-axis robot, which means that it can put the stress or the tool in any position, r theta phi for the first three joints, plus any orientation. And because of that, to actually go from a system where we specify, like the computer does, all six joints, to specifying, you know, where this tool is in space, we actually have to do a series of six coordinate transformations. And each of those coordinate transformations is both a rotation and a translation. And so Mario went through and did all the math for that and come up with a transformation from from joint coordinates to world coordinates and actually tool coordinates. And also actually a whole string of students, Mario, and also William Berry, to name probably the biggest contributors. Then what they did was they took just a bitmap image and took it as points, and they wrote a computer program to connect those points into a path. And in software, they simulated, they basically did the inverse kinematics. They, given an orientation, they actually solved backwards to what the six joints should be. And then they just had a program that looped over positions of the tool along Mickey Mouse and calculated the joints the way they should be. The actual picture comes from Savly. You can get a 3D CAD model of the robot so that you can do interference. And that's actually the reason we did this. It's not to do pretty pictures. The problem is you don't want the robot to, we don't want to hit itself. So before we machine anything, we have to simulate it. And so he got the model from, this is William Berry, he got the model of the robot from as a CAD drawing, converted it into some format that MATLAB could understand, and then basically took each object and did the transformations to manually move it by basically transforming each set of points on that arm. And then you can plot that in 3D, and that's the effect you get. So this is really the hardest step towards just putting a drill in the arm and then just telling it to go ahead and do that.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then let's thank Chris again.
Oh, we're making a Mickey Mouse now.
Yeah. So you actually talk about your green source, which is a real problem. Yeah, that's right.
They can never do that. They use a non-interactive. Well, we're a lot of stuff to use. I teach 500 books. When you have magnetic material, then you have to use all the tools. And it becomes very physical.
No, I know.
In fact, that's what we
needed. But you need to use fire though, because that's the way. For a real problem, you do a coil that looks like that. It's nice and round. And this is a tapered coil where it feels larger here, and it tapers off at just the right speed to keep.
So this is going to start out life as a PVC pipe, basically.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a copper plate PVC pipe.
Okay.
And that's a cool coil.
Yeah. And then been carefully carved up by the machine in the basement. Which is now going to have to reach inside the pipe.
Now this is actually this big, but we have actually a joint with that, so we can actually come along this way and do it that way.
Okay.
Let's go.
Do you need a right or a towel? Oh, I don't know. Yes. Well,
I have a
cut
here.
Oh, okay.
I can only get here.
No, we're fine. We have to be back. Like it's another
time. Because
we
got
to go to the opera. I mean, we have the tonight is the phantom of the opera. So Susan used more for me because of only okay. Day where we could make it, and then we actually got the tickets before we knew that you wouldn't care anyway. So we have to jump.
That's fine. And so
we have to do. So do we help you?
I could. Why don't I get a ride with you, and then I'll just come right back.
That's fine. If you go back, we might be some
actually,
time pressure.
Why don't I
think it's independent. If people stay or whatever, have questions. I don't need it. I mean, certainly we'd like to give you a ride, but we just want to. We really might be. Early before people have finished whatever.
That's
I don't
good.
Know.
So I'll just I'll just
need
a right over
really
there. We both need to be there.
Yes. That's right.
So where did these go?
Oh, I just put them there. Just there.
Okay. And then I need to take this and this. Oh, so nervous. So we have to take those down to the lab.
Okay.
And just leave it in the bag.
You can just press projectors off on that one.
Okay, projector power.
No, I think this is really bad. This is the best over there, that one.
This is terrible.
The second best, this is the worst.
I think we just need to change the settings.
I don't know what it is.
It's the closest too, which is really surprising. Oh no, it's the farthest. Maybe that's one.
Yeah, but it was good at some point, right? So.
Oh, it was?
Yeah. Don't forget your water.
Mohammed gave that to me. Mohammed gave this to me.
Oh, that's nice.
Okay, so.